A few years ago, I started noticing more and more articles and books suggesting that we here in the United States need to prepare ourselves for a post-work society. Machines, it is suggested, will be taking care of about 50% of our jobs in the next couple of decades, and it will only get worse or better depending on your point of view. Some have joked that the Luddites, who 150 years ago resorted to smashing the machines which were threatening to make humans obsolete, weren't necessarily wrong, just ahead of their time. We're going to talk about work tonight. We're going to talk about the past, present, and future of work. We have regular contributors, Dr. John Simmons and Bill Claus, joining us, as well as Dr. Fred Whitehead. We also will be talking to and listening to Jenna Ray, who has recently released her first solo CD entitled Working Woman. This is Julie Bennett-Hume, co-host and producer of River City Chautauqua. We're here today to talk to Dr. John Simmons about the future of work. And John, one thing that I have been looking at for the last 4 or 5 years have been a lot of articles that are somewhat hysterical about things such as the robots are coming, the middle class is disappearing, there won't be any jobs but for the very rich and slave labor in the future. A lot of different ideas about what's happening to work in a country like the United States, where work is basically our religion. What do you think the next 20 years look like? What do you think the next 50 years look like? What do you think the next century looks like? And most importantly, for a philosophy professor, why is it important? What do we need to be thinking about?
Okay, so there's a lot of questions there. I think probably the most challenging question that you asked is, you know, why does it matter? What does it mean, etc.? And that really gets to the question of how does our work life constitute what it is to have a meaningful life? And when we think about the future and we think about automation, it's certainly already the case that increasing numbers of traditional jobs, the kinds of jobs that gave people meaning and social status and obviously a paycheck, that those jobs are being replaced and that they're disappearing at a sort of steady rate. So when we think about the medium-term future, some of the predictions, let's say, for example, there are 3.5 million truck drivers in the United States, and this is, as many people have noted, one of the last so-called well-paying or good-paying job fields that it's really accessible to people with just a high school education. Say. So if you are a truck driver, you can possibly make $60,000, $70,000 a year driving a truck with relatively minimal formal education. If driverless trucks become a reality, and they probably will, then significant parts of that sector will disappear. And not just the 3.5 million working class jobs that are directly about driving the truck, but all of the support jobs associated with truck driving that will also disappear as a result of automation. This is a significant hit to working class America with significant political consequences. And we can we've already seen the dramatic effect, the dramatic political effect of automation on working class employment and sort of levels of despair and loss of status that the working class in the United States has felt as a result of automation, and that gets channeled and manipulated in various ways politically, but it's already clearly a consequence. It's only going to get more dramatic, for sure. And I guess that's as far ahead as I think we can confidently predict, is that automation will continue to affect relatively routine jobs that can be reduced to recipes or algorithms, and those kinds of jobs are clearly threatened by automation.
Mm-hmm. And when we look at automation, there's so many different levels to it. We're looking at everything from robots doing surgery to robots taking your order in a McDonald's kiosk, and I think that's what is causing so much uncertainty. There's some ideas about, oh, well, of course, a machine can do that. But there's other people that there's an uncertainty. Well, am I at a point where I someday can be replaced? This isn't just, a steel town or a coal town. You know, could this be the kind of thing where, you know, my job that requires sophisticated intelligence can
be replaced by a machine that has more sophisticated intelligence.
Yeah, so I think anything that genuinely involves human imagination, contextual sensitivity, style, creativity, maybe even passion or appreciation of beauty, it's certainly not within our lifetimes that we'll see machines eliminating those kinds of jobs. The kinds of work that are already disappearing would really be the kinds of things that are easy to turn into recipes, that are routine, that are in some sense monotonous. Those could be white collar jobs, right? So due diligence in a law firm. So going through vast amounts of paperwork and searching for keywords and for key phrases or for these kinds of things that might have traditionally been done by first year associates at a law firm. Those kinds of things are already being routinized and automated. And so, yeah, there'll be fewer attorneys for sure. We see attempts to do this in, for example, in my field in education. We see attempts to push for more mechanical online learning kinds of experiences. But, you know, it hasn't really succeeded in providing the same level of quality as an in-person class to date. People disagree about that, but mostly it's partisans pushing for online education. It's going to be, I think, most people who are happy with their jobs, who are involved in things that involve, you know, genuinely meaningful practices, their jobs are probably fine. I mean, if you're a craftsperson, if you're an artisan, if you're making beautiful things, if you're involved in these kinds of practices that are kind of ideal anyway, then your job is probably safe.
Yes. I have read that a lot of people talk about how the next 30 to 50 years are going to be the artisan age, where we see a reemergence of people on a small scale doing everything from craft beer to furniture to musically to me, book printing and different things that are, you know, people crave that machines will not be able to give them.
Exactly. And I think there's a bourgeois fetish for things that are made by hand or made in a careful way. But whatever its source, I think that a reality. We do value things that are made carefully and made beautifully and made personally. So we value uniqueness. We value craftsmanship.
Exactly.
And those are also enterprises where people derive great meaning in the actual practice of being an artist or an artisan or a craftsman, et cetera, that we will continue to value probably more. I mean, it's almost like a luxurious condition to be in, that we value the beautifully made over the mass produced.
Yes, right? And it's like when we talk about these kind of things, as you mentioned, there's this bourgeois quality. There's something that rings a bell in my mind of a Dartmouth graduate that got really good at making pottery and now makes it and sells it to, you know, 7 or 8 rich people in their little village in the Hamptons or whatever. You know, there's something about it that when we're talking about the struggling working class, it could be a phenomenon that comes about, but it doesn't seem to me to be particularly
sure.
to be a solution.
So, yes. Right. So I think, yeah, so these kinds of maybe boutique-y artisanal solutions to the world of work, like the micro farms and the ceramicists from Dartmouth that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are a result of the fact that we live in a period of extraordinary wealth. And that fact is sort of permitting these kinds of luxuries. And that'll allow a lot of people to thrive and survive. But as you said, I mean, that's not a solution for the 3.5 million truck drivers who are going to be needing some new way to derive meaning and status and value for their own work. Clearly, many of them will find meaningful and valuable ways of spending their time. Maybe it'll be a blessing for them to lose the trucking job. They'll find something else to do. But for others, it is going to be a challenge. It's also really hard. And as those of us in midlife know, it's really hard to change gears, and it's really hard to, you know, reinvent yourself in your 40s or your 50s mm-hmm. in that kind of way. So it's going to be a crisis for a lot of folks.
It leads me to a question then that I think is important for you to discuss with us today. There is an account of the town of Youngstown, Ohio. After World War II, a city that had been very prosperous, lost 50,000 jobs. Once the war was over, there was great economic disruption, But what was even more significant was the psychological or cultural breakdown. The city reported that depression, suicide, spousal abuse skyrocketed. It seems that when the job security went away, when the jobs went away, that basically the cultural cohesion of Youngstown went away as well. And I'm interested in what you think might be ahead. What are some of these challenges that might be ahead when basically this meaning goes away, you know, this cohesion that a job has brought to us and our place in the community?
I mean, it's clearly, I mean, hillbilly elegy and other sorts of, studies of these things indicate that, once that traditional cultural structure is gone, and it needn't just be work, it could also be the traditional family, it could also be traditional religious practice, etc. Once those things are gone, it's very difficult for most of us to reconstruct an orderly or coherent kind of daily life. Things like work organize our day. They shape our day. They give it a kind of shape, a kind of structure, a trajectory. We're able to think of our lives as having a kind of narrative structure. And those things are they seem to be very, very important to us, to most of us. Not all of us, but to most of us. And I think, we're going to have to find non-work related ways of organizing the meanings of our lives. And I think that's going to be a significant challenge. I think cultural artistic practices are also vital. I think a kind of recognition of the importance of meaning in leisure and literature and television and music, these are all going to be things that we are going to have to invest in. So there will be a need to create a kind of culture where people are nourished in the absence of a kind of routinized work life. So we shouldn't glamorize working in a factory necessarily, or working in a meaningless job. We shouldn't romanticize the fact that most jobs are oppressive and that most work environments involve, you know, abusive kinds of hierarchies and exploitation, etc. Most jobs are crappy jobs. It's true. That's why you get paid to do them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's what the jobs afford. It's how the jobs create status, create an order to the day. And those are things that help us live valuable lives, and they also support other important, meaningful things like your role as a parent, your ability to take care of your children, your standing in the community, respect from others. And so those kinds of structures that organize the meaning of our life, when they go away, it's a significant challenge, and we do have to reconstruct. Rebuild.
In a post-work society, it has been suggested that one thing that has suffered in this workaholic kind of society we have are human relationships, and that a lot of jobs that we have, whether it's nursing or daycare, a lot of jobs where human relationships are central are really undervalued in our society. They tend to be really low paying jobs. You know, the person that takes care of your relative in hospice care, you know, that person that takes care of your infant, even the people that teach your children, your young children. And it's been suggested that maybe this is an area where our worth could come from, where some of that pride could come from, that maybe has been undervalued. Maybe the human relationship will be one of the winners in this new world order. What do you think of that? Is that overly optimistic?
So most of the things that are most valuable for us and most meaningful in our lives are unpaid.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So being a father, being a mother, being a good friend. I mean, you can't imagine a good friend being paid to be a good friend. Teachers are paid, but you don't pay for grades, for example, right?
Yeah.
So if we think about the importance of those kinds of relationships, often they're important in virtue of being voluntary, unpaid, uncoerced. So if if we're going to recognize relationships as sort of a locus of value in our lives, I don't think that recognizing them is necessarily about attaching economic value to them. So that I don't think we want to marketize human relations. I think, you know, we need ways to have non-market based recognitions of human value. I think the worst thing that's happening to us is the commodification of people and relationships. Yeah. We don't want to turn ourselves into products or companies or objects for sale. We simply cannot have things like friendship and love in a market. There is no market for friendship. If you're paid to be my friend, you're not my friend. If you're paid to be my wife, then you're a prostitute. You're not my wife. So we need to recognize that this important dimension of human value is separate from money and markets, and that it can't live with money and markets. We need to protect those spaces for genuine human relations that aren't just driven by economic imperatives. That's what I think.
However, let's think about something like the fact that we have an aging population. When we talk about having people to come in and care for people on a regular basis, do you think that there is a way of shifting some of our focus once we are dealing with more and more machines replacing? I know figures we've looked at are 50% of jobs will be replaced by machines in the next 20 years. You know, there's all kinds of numbers out there, but nobody's denying that machines are going to replace a few things. Having a special needs daughter, I think about people that might be watching after her. And I, you know, of course, I don't think in terms of machines. I think in terms of human beings that can be paid to care for her and make sure her needs are being met when her father and I are no longer around. I think about elderly relatives and people that come care for them. I'm just wondering if some of our focus might change in what we see as being jobs that are valuable and where a human being that you can have a relationship with. I'm not saying that human being becomes a commodity, but I'm saying that these kind of human services, do you think that there is a place for them that might be of greater value? Since most of us don't want to say, well, yeah, my dad's in hospice and I have a robot watching him when I can't be there. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. On the one hand, I would prefer, if I were incapacitated, I would prefer to have a robot taking care of sort of intimate care and these kinds of things for me than another person. I'd find it to be more dignified and et cetera. So in some ways, I think we might end up preferring robots for certain kinds of care. And we might see that as a way of maintaining my autonomy and my integrity. I don't have to be nice to the robot. I can bark orders at the robot. I can be exposed to the robot in ways that are, you know, irrelevant, like being exposed to the vacuum cleaner. I think I can be weak around the machines in ways that I might not want to be weak around or vulnerable around humans. Having said that, I agree that areas of work that require human compassion, human sensitivity, will become more widely appreciated. I think that's inevitable as we live in a more automated, more mechanical age. But notice that many younger people are, I'm not saying this is a good thing, but many younger people are actually more socially isolated than people of our age, and they seem to like it. That's a different question.
But it's related to it. And I do believe that this social isolation where we're, you know, we're doing everything with our little machines and they will do everything for us, I think that it actually gives us a false sense of independence. When you're talking about, for example, the end of my life and these functions, and it's so humiliating, I think about Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Ilyich, great, where he really recognizes how fragile he is and his humanity by that suffering and by having human beings that he maybe at one point would have looked down on, and now he has this incredible respect for them and what they do. And I think it's important to remember that, which brings me to my next question. As an educator, what is a university going to look like 50 years from now?
So you know, the universities are increasingly run by administrators, and administrators have become a kind of professional class of managers who sort of mimic the habits and behaviors as they understand them of the business classes of corporate leaders. They have increasingly vocationalized our universities, and they've increasingly pandered to very short-term thinking about work and the market, etc. It's certainly the case that very little interesting innovation, very little interesting creativity comes from, for example, a business school. A business school is basically an enormous waste of money. We don't really see the kinds of creativity that's driven the American economy since the Second World War coming out of highly vocational contexts. You know, very practically, it's often shocking to parents when they're told that the median mid-career salary, for example, of a philosophy major is, let's say, in the high $80,000 range, whereas the median mid-career salary of a nursing major is in the $60,000 range, or that the median mid-career salary of someone taking a criminal justice degree, for example, is in the 40 to 50. This is Wall Street Journal statistics. So it's often incredibly short-sighted to say that, you know, we need to push students for vocational degrees, in part because it turns out the history is that it hasn't been the golden ticket that some parents might believe or that some administrators might push. It's also the case now in this context that the kind of jobs that are vocationalized, the kinds of jobs that can be routinized or turned into recipes, are precisely the places that are most likely to be automated, where those jobs will disappear. I don't think that 50% of jobs will disappear. I think 50% of what we currently think of as, you know, employment won't be the kind of employment that people do or are engaged in 20 years. There is no major to satisfy the kind of career that will emerge over the next 20 years. So we can't think about education vocationally anymore. I think that's a failed model. You know, when you think about skills for the tech industry, for example, a computer science department is preparing people to be the kinds of people who can learn new programming languages, new techniques, new approaches, etc. But presumably they're not able to keep up with that. So it's futile to try and teach students, for example, a computer language that's already obsolete if the purpose is to teach them the computer language, if the purpose is to teach them how to think about software, how to be a programmer, etc. That's a different story. So providing people the capacity to retool, to learn, etc., that's the new role of the university, not to prepare people to be welders or existing jobs. Now, there's nothing wrong with being a welder. I planned at one point in my career to be an electrician, and there'll always be electrician jobs. There'll always be welding jobs to some extent. But if we're thinking about the classical model of the four-year university, the goal is to get people in a position where they're able to retool, where they're able to adjust, where their imagination is cultivated, where their own human dignity is cultivated, where their freedom, their autonomy is valued. That's critical. Not to treat them as consumers, not to treat them as cannon fodder for corporations.
Yes, a couple of things come to me when you're talking about that. And one of them I do want to point out, as I'll give a little plug for a philosophy department. When I was an undergraduate at KU, I had two classes that could be considered computer science classes. And one of them was Fortran. And it was really interesting and really fun. And you know, this is back in the early 80s. And so I had to go to this huge thing, a computer that was the size of a room, and do all kinds of programming with this. Just a fascinating course. By the time I graduated from college, nobody needed to know Fortran anymore. You know, within a 2-year period, really, that Fortran, you know, you'd say you'd studied Fortran and people kind of giggle. However, I had another course, and it was from Donald Brownstein, who used to be a professor at KU.
Yeah.
And it was a symbolic logic class.
Yeah.
And I learned so much from that class, and I was basically in there with computer science majors.
Yeah.
And years later, I thought about the kind of thinking that I learned in that class and the kind of problem solving that I learned in that class. And that's the kind of class where I go to take it today. It'd be just as valuable to me as it was, you know, 35 years ago because of what I learned how to do in that class.
Good.
And so I think that's an important distinction about what really an education should do. As a retired teacher, something that was very troubling to me, and it's something that's still going on, is about 10 years ago, they started this thing with 8th and 9th grade students just getting into their high school career called a career track. And they would ask them, what they wanted to be. What was ironic about it was at the same time, these kids would go to lectures where they'd hear, the job you're going to have in the future may not even exist yet. On the other hand, what do you want to be? And so the kids would say something like, you know, maybe he was an astronaut or actress, but it was a lot of times it was doctor or engineer, you know, a few very practical ideas at the time, a computer, a lot of times it was computer science. Then you talk to them about what kind of classes they're going to take. You know, as a 14, 15-year-old, well, I don't need foreign language for the career track I'm on. And, you know, they'd have this little thing printed out for them, and foreign language would not be on there. And, of course, I don't need mathematics. I'm going into nursing or whatever. And I just found it so frustrating. Everyone should study foreign language that's interested in being educated. Everyone should study mathematics. You know, to me, it's just so frustrating. And it's still going on in education. You know, this a lot of times what supposedly STEM is really just job training. And it's definitely throwing out the baby with the bathwater in many cases, and really not having people take the kind of courses that could really help them in a number of situations.
So administrators of schools are driven by market forces. They are concerned by how the market values. They see students as a product that they're providing to corporations. They don't understand that, for example, in Don Brownstein's class that you took, you were learning the foundations of computer science. When you study symbolic logic is the basis yes. of computer science. So historically, the origins of computer science come from work that philosophers and logicians did in the early 20th century. As a sort of a side note, Don Brownstein is now a billionaire. Maybe you know this.
I heard this, yes.
he developed financial instruments around the sort of in the emergence of the hedge fund era, and is now a billionaire hedge fund manager.
Wonderful. It's extraordinary. Wonderful, he found something to do yeah. with his philosophy degree.
So Don is a case where someone who had very fond of Don, but he's someone who's taken that kind of creative capacity and turned it into something obviously ridiculously highly marketable. But being marketable, being of market value, I repeat, is not what this is about. We are not products. We are not commodities. And we shouldn't treat our students that way. People shouldn't treat themselves that way. There's more to life than just what you can put a price on. You cannot price friendship. You cannot price love. You cannot price meaning.
Well, I think we're out of time here. We've been talking to Dr. John Simmons, a regular contributor on River City Chautauqua, and we thank you, John, for your time.
Real
today.
Pleasure.
Yeah,
real pleasure
you.
Talking, Julie.
As a young man, I developed a passion and a love for music of the labor struggles, going back to the Knights of Labor, the IWW, the CIO, the AFL-CIO, and just such great songs as Which Side Are You On?, Union Made, Solidarity Forever. Now, there's a song that has an interesting history. It's been the labor's anthem for the AFL-CIO for decades, but it actually dates way back to 1915 when it appeared in the Little Red Songbook by the Industrial Workers of the World. And the song was written actually by Ralph Chaplin, a wobbly and that 1915 version written to the tune of John Brown's Body. But the whole notion of solidarity forever really captures the ideal of what the labor movement is all about. Solidarity being an injury to one is an injury to all. We all have to stick together. It's easier to break one stick than a bundle of sticks. And so that just kind of captured my imagination as a young man, and I've tried to live up to those ideals ever since. And it's just part of a long history of a very rich culture of music, and I like to think in my small way, I have contributed to it over the years. I first got involved in the labor movement in 1978. I was not involved with the Labor Council at that time, but I did write an anti-right-to-work song, and I wrote a skit, a little theater skit, and a friend of mine went to the labor leaders and said, hey, we'd like to take this around to labor unions to kind of gather people's support for fighting against right-to-work, and had a great deal of fun doing that, and we won that fight, and it was a great victory for the working class here in Missouri. As a result of being involved with in my small way with that fight, I did get to know some of the labor leaders around was involved in that. And a few years after that, I don't know, it was 81 or 82, Harry Spring, who had been much involved with the fight against right to work, at that time he was an organizer for Service Employees Local 96. A couple of years after the fight for against right to work, he became the secretary treasurer of the Greater Kansas City Central Labor Council, AFL-CIO. And he was a good friend of mine. So anyway, he called me up and says, well, you know, Bill, you wrote this song about right to work. There's a big fight going on at the Kansas City Star, and we need somebody to, how would you like to write a song about the fight going on at the Kansas City Star? And I thought, well, it's a good cause. I really don't consider myself a songwriter. I've written a few songs over the years, but it's not a great passion of mine. I figure the American Songbook has a lot of great tunes, and they don't need a whole bunch of mediocre ones added to it by yours truly. But nevertheless, I figured it was a good thing. So with a certain amount of trepidation, I mean, after all, it's one thing to write a song because you become inspired. It's another thing to write it if you get commissioned. And knowing I was going to take this around to a whole group of different people that I didn't know made me a little bit nervous, but I thought, okay. So I learned what are some of the issues going on with the Kansas City Star. Put those issues down in verse form. I came up with a chorus. It was a decent chorus, you know, where there's a little bit of answer back and a chance to sing along. Thought it was a fairly good song. Was still pretty nervous about going out and performing this in public. But nonetheless, I figure it's a good cause. I did write the song. And then one Saturday morning, out of the blue, Harry Spring calls me up and says, hey, there's a picnic going on, a union picnic going on. And I would like you to come out and premiere your song at this union picnic. Well, to say I was nervous would be quite an understatement. But I'd done the best I could, and I figured it was a good cause. So that Saturday morning, I piled in the van with my guitar and headed out to Swope Park with Harry Spring. Well, we come up over the hill at Swope Park, and there before me was, to my way of figuring, the largest union picnic in the history of Western civilization. Now, I didn't get an exact count, but it seemed to me there must have been 10,000 people at this Swope Park picnic. It seemed that when the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Local 500 held a picnic, everybody showed up. Well, this did not help to calm my nerves. But as bad as it was, having what it looked to me like 10,000 people there that I was going to be performing this brand new song for, it got even worse. Because when I took a closer look, it looked to me that somewhere between 70 and 90% of these union brothers and sisters were African American. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about race here, but I'm talking about culture. I mean, I have grown up in the city, and I can't say that I'm an expert on African-American culture, but I was pretty sure that when African-Americans went out and they were looking for a good time and they're looking for the entertainment, at the top of their list of people to entertain them is not going to be a young white guy singing a folk song that he just wrote on an acoustic guitar. You know what I mean? Well, this did not help to calm my nerves. But as bad as this was, it still got worse. Because there in the middle of those 10,000 union brothers and sisters holding forth at this picnic was a flatbed truck. And on top of that flatbed truck was an 8-piece Kick Out the Jams funkadelic jam band. I mean, we're talking about professional union musicians out just showing off their chops for their union brothers and sisters. And these cats were all just jamming together. Everybody was having a great time. And out in the audience, the dudes were dancing with their dudettes, and moms had their sons on their shoulders dancing around, and dads were dancing with their daughters, and everybody had their hands in the air, and they were clapping and having a good time and laughing and just really grooving to the music. And I was going to follow that band. In effect, that band was my warm-up act. This did not help to calm my nerves. But, as bad as this was, it got even worse. Because what happened next will be seared in my memory for all the days of my life. I followed Harry Spring up to the back of that flatbed truck and climbed up on there. And while that band was grooving out, showing their chops, and everybody was dancing around and having a good time, and fathers were dancing with daughters, and mothers had their... Harry Spring walked up to the microphone and said, could I have your attention, please? Could I have your attention, please? And all eight people in that eight-piece Kick Out the Jams funkadelic kick-ass jam band stopped with mouth agape, and all eight people with their 16 eyeballs stared at Harry Spring. And all 10,000 people in the audience stopped in the middle of their dance and stared with their 20,000 eyes and their mouth agape at Harry Spring. And Harry said, "I have a real treat for you today. Brother Bill Claus has written a song that I know you're all going to want to hear." Now, as Homo sapiens, there are certain evolutionary responses we have when we get a sudden infusion of adrenaline. You know, I think this goes back to savannah and saber-toothed tigers or something like that. But the whole flight or fight thing clicked in with me because I wanted nothing more to do than to gently set down my guitar, walk over to Harry Spring, and choke the life out of him. But I figured I couldn't do that because I had 20,016 eyeballs staring at me. I also thought it might be a good idea to engage the flight part and just pick up my guitar, hop off of the flatbed, and disappear into the horizon. But I figured that wasn't going to work too well either. So I did the only thing I could do. I walked up to the microphone. Now, as bad as this was, it got even worse, because that's not the only thing that happens when you get a sudden infusion of adrenaline and you become terrified of the moment. Another thing that happens is, well, your voice box constricts and you have a very shallow breathing pattern, so that when you talk or when you try to sing, your voice will tend to crack and not be very loud. And the other thing that happens when you have a sudden infusion of adrenaline and you become terrified on the spot is you kind of develop an instantaneous advanced form of Parkinson's disease because you lose all fine motor control. Now, this is not a good thing if you play the guitar. It's especially not a good thing if you're not a very good guitar player to begin with. Now, my whole life, my friends will tell you, I have lived up to my own motto that between picking and grinning, I'm a lot better at grinning. So I'm not the best guitar player in the world anyway, but when I am infused with adrenaline, it gets even worse because, well, when you try to play the guitar and your hands just won't cooperate, it kind of sounds like, well, like maybe you took a tennis racket and strung it with baling wire. So this was not the ideal way for me to give this world premiere of this song I had written and that I was already nervous enough about. So with 20,016 eyeballs glued on me, I started playing my new song. And my voice would squeak a little bit through the verse, getting up to the chorus. And to nobody's surprise, they continued to stare at me as I sang the part where I wanted them to answer back, where I sang the part that I was hoping they would kind of clap along and sing along with. And I was still terrified. But a funny thing happened when I got into the second verse. Down towards the front a little bit, a few of the people started clapping along to me, calm me down just a little bit. And I noticed towards the back, a little bit of them kind of started dancing around and were kind of looking at me to give me a little bit of courage. And then an amazing thing happened when I got to the chorus. First, a very few down front started answering back. And the second time around, more people started answering back. And by the time I got through the chorus, a whole group of them were starting to sing along with me and to clap time and keep time for me. And that really helped me a great deal. I started to calm down and my motor control got a little bit more control of my chord making ability, and my guitar playing got a little stronger. My voice got a little stronger. And I even got to kind of calm down and start dancing around a little bit and got even a little bit cocky. And when I got to the chorus, they were screaming the words back at me, and they were clapping along, and they were enjoying the song. And when I got done, there was just a roar of applause, and everyone shouted their approval. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that my skills were such that I won them over with my talent. I know there was a whole lot of pity applause involved, but it was more than that. It was more than that. I came there with the idea that what I was going to do was teach them a lesson by teaching them about what's going on with the Kansas City Star, teaching them about union solidarity. But it turns out they're the ones that taught me the lesson. Because when I had got there, what I did is I looked out at this mass of humanity, and I thought about how different I was from them. But what they taught me is when they looked up at me and they heard me sing this song about union rights, about workers' rights, about solidarity, about sticking together, they saw what we had in common, and they applauded the fact that we were all in this together. So although I thought I was teaching them a lesson, they taught me the real meaning of the concept of solidarity.
Hey everybody, this is Jenna Ray. I'm here today talking about the working woman. I'm a registered nurse by day here in Kansas City and a musician and singer-songwriter by night. I recently released my debut album. It's a country album and there's 12 tracks and it's called Working Woman. The title of the album was born when I realized how many songs I'd written with the theme of work. Some of them are just about work in general, and some about being a working woman specifically. And the title track, called Working Woman, is a response to a Merle Haggard song called Working Man Blues. I listen to a lot of classic country, and I find myself relating more to the lyrics behind some of the men's songs, like Merle Haggard and Waylon Jennings, and they did a lot of songs that talk about work, and a lot of the ladies that I listen to, Loretta Lynn, Tammy Wynette, a lot of their songs talked about being a housewife and staying home, and I really hoped this album would celebrate how far we have come to include women in the workforce and make women proud to be out there working. I dedicated the whole album to my mom, and in this song you'll understand why. I'm gonna go ahead and play you the title track now. Slow. Grab my purse and then I hit the road. Just like that, hear those trains. So like I said, I dedicated my album to my mom, and I was raised by two very hardworking parents, and I remember being a little kid, and my mom stayed home with us for a while when we were all young, and I remember when she went back to work full-time, and she's a physical therapist, and, you know, nowadays it's so rare that a mom is able to stay home with her kids. You know, all of my friends, I'm 28 years old, and I think I have one friend that's a stay-at-home mom. But both my parents, they both worked a lot when I was younger, and when I was in college, I was playing in an all-girl band. I was already well into my nursing degree, and I called my mom at one point and told her I wasn't so sure I wanted to be a nurse anymore. I think I just wanted to play music and try to make a living with music, and she really encouraged me to stay in school and get my degree, and I'm glad she pushed me in that direction, and it's one of the reasons I dedicated this album to her. I really feel lucky to get to be in a time like this, where there is equal rights, and I know there's more work to be done, and there's a track on my album that I tell the story of a lady I know who played music 30 years ago or 40 years ago. She played with some really big bands and toured all over, and she has a great voice, and she just told me how, you know, she was forced to wear certain things, and it was really hard to get her music out there, and she always ended up being a backup singer, and there's a lot of opportunity that I have nowadays that she didn't have back when she was doing music. I'm gonna go ahead and play you that track from my album. This one is called She Wore Those Heels. Well, she wore those heels for so many years that her feet began to never feel very right. So she went to her boss and said, I just can't wear these heels anymore. Gave her a letter of resignation and said goodbye. Thank you. being a working woman in today's America, I think, holds a lot more opportunities that weren't there many years ago. But I think there's a lot of responsibility that comes along with it, too. I think both men and women want to see women be successful, and they want to see women in leadership roles, and I hope the same thing. At the same time, I know that as long as, you know, women are the only ones that can have children, I think that there will always be a pay gap, because, you know, about right about my age, most people are getting married and having kids, and there's a lot of other things that you can do, but it's still what you're kind of expected to do. And going, you know, the different way is not as common. The great thing about today is there is a lot of opportunity, and I think there's so much that we can learn just for free on the internet. My partner and I, Martin, he's the other half of my Cosmic Western duo, we remodeled a school bus recently, and we turned it into a little RV, and we've been touring and traveling out of this bus, and, you know, we learned everything ourselves online. And I think success in America today is measured by how much money you make, but I also think that there's a change happening, and that a lot of people are seeing on the internet what all is out there, and they're deciding to, you know, live their lives not just working a job, but working for themselves and doing what makes them happy. And like for me, I went to school to be a nurse. I worked really hard to be a nurse and expected myself to do it for a long time, and have started this new career path with music. And although it doesn't make a lot of money at this point, you know, I've released this album and a lot of people have heard it. And at the end of the day, to me, that's successful. And I worked hard on music to get where I am, and I'm going to keep going at it. I just hope that things keep moving in this direction, and that people don't just do what's expected of them, and that working hard doesn't have to mean making lots of money. It's working hard at what you want to do and what makes you happy and what makes the people around you happy. Well, thank you so much to Julie Bennett Hume for inviting me to come on today and talk about my album and about being a working woman. I'm Jenna Ray, and if you want to check out more about me and about my album, you can check out LostCowgirlRecords.com. You can also download the album from all major digital platforms. Lost Cowgirl Records is a brand new record label out of Kansas City that supports female Americana voices, and Julie's actually releasing a album on there very soon. Well, thank you so much, and take care.
I'm Fred Whitehead, a labor historian and a person with industrial experience in welding and warehouses and working on railroads. But in addition to being a historian, I've always tried to engage with the issues of the day. After the elections of 2010, which resulted in the Republicans taking control of Congress again, I thought, well, how can we respond to this? And not just in an immediate way, but with some sense of a long-term perspective. And what I came up with was a project which I called Vote for a Job. And I wrote up a call to action, part of which I'll read, which will explain this proposal. What happened with the Republicans taking power in 2010, there was a well-funded and pervasive deployment of think tanks of reactionaries launching a campaign to eliminate the language of rights, relabeling it as entitlements. People were thrown on the defensive politically, educationally, and in the courts. What I'd like to propose as a response is a campaign for a constitutional amendment guaranteeing the right to employment. This is not merely an abstract utopian idea. It is deeply rooted in the American experience. Notably, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt called for it in his message to Congress January 11, 1944, calling for a second Bill of Rights. Point number one was, quote, the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation, unquote. Among other rights were the right to housing, medical care, and education. It's also been pointed out that this right was included in the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Eleanor Roosevelt assisted in putting together, especially Article 23. quote, "Everyone has the right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment." Well, it's clear that changing the Constitution is a prolonged and difficult process, but I'd have to say we need to realize that most of the Constitution was written in the 18th century. And so my idea was that we should have a Constitution that represents the conditions and needs of the 21st century. Putting the right to employment into the Constitution would mean a guarantee to all that they have a secure place in our society. It would not be subject to the whims of this or that president or Congress. It would become part of our organic law. If we have this right in the Constitution, when you go to the employment office, you come out with a job. If not in the private sector, then in the public one, in new forms of the Civilian Conservation Corps or the Works Project Administration of the 1930s. The respected Chicago artist Peggy Lipschitz recalls finding work in the WPA. "You got a job on the basis that you were an artist. You didn't apply for some grant and just hope to be awarded one. Hundreds of artists all around the nation went to work in these programs." Such a right would at once eliminate barbarous competition among races and generations. The campaign to enact it would engage literally millions of people on their own behalf and on behalf of all. We would take back ancient language of rights arising from our own original Bill of Rights and extending it to meet the needs of the present day. One thing I might note is in Missouri, there was a successful referendum campaign to defeat the right to work legislation. And Missouri is one of the states that you can have a petition by the citizens and voters to get a measure on the ballot. And one of the things that we could imagine would be a campaign in the states to get this into state constitutions, which might later form the basis for federal enactment. Well, I issued a bulletin after this call, in which I just want to read a little bit of this text. "I should confess at once that I'm not a sports fan, but the other day it occurred to me out of the blue that the idea of a constitutional amendment guaranteeing the right to a job has an aspect that bears on games or game theory. While the right wing has had strategic plans in place since before Reagan became president, the left has failed to come up with anything that can take them on. Failure to have a strategy at all means failure in the long run, and often in the short run too. In most sports, there's an offense and a defense working in every game. Any person or team that has only a defense is doomed to defeat eventually. In part, lacking an offense, you don't ever score any points. Also, if you're only defensive, your opponent on the offensive not only has the momentum, but he can study your defense and pick out the weaknesses in it. In a purely defensive strategy, however good that may be, there is then an inherent weakness. Of course, in any sport, great defense is critically important. And having a poorly defined or executed offense has its perils as well." So what happened was the labor movement practically through most of my lifetime has been defensive, and it lacks a strategic vision. So I circulated this call to action to labor movements, to Jobs with Justice, to local people that I knew, and essentially it died for lack of response or interest. I later wrote an essay about this, which was published in a book edited by Charlie Wrights called The Crisis and Commonwealth, which tried to talk about the campaign and how I tried to reach people and the implications of people really not doing anything. I would say one other thing from a historical standpoint. The Homestead Act of 1862, enacted by the United States Congress, provided people an opportunity to obtain and settle and farm land in the Midwest and West. And the person who lived on that land was guaranteed 160 acres, which is a quarter section. And people realized that congressional action was the way to get this done. And I would submit that if instead of voting for a farm, we can vote for a job. And voting, therefore, is not just some kind of meaningless exercise, but something that would result in a major change in our conditions and our opportunities in organized society.
That concludes this evening's show. Thank you to Dr. John Simmons, Dr. Fred Whitehead, Bill Kloss, Jenna Ray, and editor Ben Hume. Join us next week when our theme will be Truth in the 21st Century.